I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In our time, it is broadly true that political writing is bad writing. That was George Orwell, 1945, in England. Political speech and writing, he said, are largely the defense of the indefensible. In his time, that meant, for example, the continuance of British rule in India. In our time, you could say, it covers mass incarceration, unconscionable tax privileges, pollution, inequality. Orwell's point in that famous essay was that bad language, flabby, indirect, cliché, blustery, stock phrases, are fair warning that bad politics is afoot. So this hour, the light that language casts on our 2016 campaign. It's a contest without a quotable speech so far. It's a battle of gestures, mockery, spectacle, and surprises that the writing class did not see coming. Here's a taste of the candidates playing the media.
These are they are so dishonest. And if I didn't have a big speaker system in terms of my mouth, but the people that listen to it, and Twitter, @RealDonaldTrump, by the way. But no, it's so great. This Twitter, Facebook is so great because when they lie on television, I type out, you know, ding, ding, ding. I'll do it myself. Ding, ding, dong, dong, ding, press. And they go like 12 seconds later, we have breaking news from Donald Trump. He is just the craziest thing. I was watching CNN before.
I'll give you one example, all right? A recent study showed that on ABC, Evening News, Trump over a period of time got 81 minutes of time. Bernie Sanders got 20 seconds. Now you tell me why. Trump is very smart. He knows that media is not so interested in the serious issues facing this country. They love silly remarks. If he says that somebody is sweating, my God, that is a major story, and all that silly business, the personal attacks, that kind of works. So I think this is more of an indictment of the media, actually, than it is of Trump.
David Bromwich at Yale is going to be our model close reader of political language in the press and on the stump against the gold standard in English of Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, Lincoln, Webster, MLK, and JFK. We begin, though, with Jay Rosen, who watches media in theory and practice for students at New York University and for old pros who read feverishly his blog forum, Press Think. Jay Rosen, welcome to Open Source. How many ways can you identify what feels like a breakdown in the public conversation in 2016?
Well, the part of it that I'm most interested in, as you know, Chris, is the press's role in the campaign. And there, I think, the breakdown is almost complete. The model of campaign coverage that almost all of the mainstream press uses dates from the 1970s. And the conditions under which it was formed are almost all evaporated. When it started, the distribution of messages was hard and it was expensive. Now it's easy and cheap. Back then, you had basically three choices if you wanted to get your message out. You could go to door-to-door, which was really difficult. You could buy an ad from the media, or you could earn news coverage. Now, as Donald Trump said in the clip we just heard, politicians can go direct. Back when campaign coverage was started in this current model, trust in government was high. Trust in the media was high. Now, both have collapsed. Back then, there were liberals in both parties. The Cold War consensus was still in place. Bipartisan compromise was a thing in politics. Now, all of that is gone. So all of the conditions under which the current model was formed have evaporated, but journalists didn't really change their way of going about it. So the collapse for them has been almost complete. And they know this. They themselves will tell you that our gatekeeping powers are gone. We can't police the discourse anymore. We can't discipline the candidates. Our fact checks don't have any effect. And so the collapse of routine, of certainty, of approach in political journalism is almost complete.
But how do the wise men, the big institutions, famous mainstream media, explain a huge misreading of trends, of people, of the mood of the country?
They don't really explain it. They admit it. They are embarrassed by it. They are the first to say, I got it wrong, too. Of course, there's comfort in the sense that everyone got it wrong. But they don't really explain it. They say things like, this is a year of political outrage, or this is the cycle in which the political establishment is completely mistrusted, or no one saw Trump coming to the fore the way he has. So they don't explain it, but on the other hand, they didn't explain to themselves or to us how they got the Iraq war wrong, how they got the financial collapse wrong either. So explaining big mistakes like this is not exactly the forte of mainstream journalism.
It's getting sad and terribly ironic, Jay. You made your reputation decades ago telling the political media that it's the mind and the mood of the voters. It's not those overstudied candidates. It's the people who will decide the outcome and make the history. You could have saved the pundits a lot of embarrassment if they'd known the condition of the country. Why don't they?
Yeah.
Why don't we?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, but the one that I think is important for listeners to understand is that the permanent class of people who produce campaign coverage and political journalism decided for a lot of reasons that they would focus their efforts on what they call, it's a very awkward, ugly term, the process. Or to put it another way, they see their mission as bringing us inside the process for how an election is won. And there's a lot of reasons why they settled on that as their mission. The most important is that while they're fascinated by politics and they're committed to it as a subject, as a beat, they're also required by their employers, by the conditions of commercial media, not to have any politics themselves. And so how do you square that circle? A commitment to politics, but also a detachment. Well, The easiest way is to be fascinated by the process, by political technique. And when you are focused on that, the people out there, the voters, your fellow citizens, become the objects of political technique. And this is what insider journalism really is. Mm. It's made for political junkies, and it talks about the voters as the objects, the people on whom political strategy is deployed. And when you look at people that way, when you see them that way, you're not in the best position to understand them.
Try this, Jay. I see a more and more obvious alignment of legacy media with the legacy candidates and the party figures, both parties. And they're all in trouble, and they're sticking together. To overstate it just a little, isn't it easy to see the New York Times, the networks, as the Jeb Bush of media?
Well, they certainly thought Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton were the most likely candidates. After Bush faltered, they switched to Marco Rubio as the most likely Republican candidate, and they were wrong about that, too. But yeah, sure, legacy media, legacy candidates go hand in hand. But I think the reason for that is the journalist's fascination with the process, with political professionals who have, they thought, mastered the art of electioneering. The people they identify with are not necessarily the candidates. They don't see themselves as on anyone's team. They see themselves as the questioners of the candidates, even to some degree the critics. But the people they identify with are the managers, the pollsters, the strategists, the handlers, the people who cycle to cycle live off politics, the way Max Weber described. In his famous essay, Politics is a Vocation, he distinguishes between people who live for politics, that is, who care about it because they want something done, and people who live off politics, who are the professionals. Mm-hmm. And journalists identify with others who live off politics, and that is what has brought them in alignment, as it were, with legacy candidates.
There's a technological change, too, obviously, but you're right. I mean, the big brands in journalism are losing audience, losing revenue. The dynastic candidates are seeping support. The force, the real force, is trying to relocate somewhere in Twitter, maybe, and in independent protest voices. This feels like the end of one era and the start of a new one.
It does. I mean, sometimes my instinct is that to interpret the campaign, the Trump campaign especially, as just a giant billboard saying to the political class, this is how much we hate you. And, of course, journalists are included in the political class, but, and this is crucial, Chris, they don't see it that way. They don't think of themselves as part of the political class that is being put down and rejected in this election, but they are. In fact, in an interview I did in my blog, Press Think, with Chuck Todd when he took over Meet the Press, I specifically asked him if he thought of himself as part of the political class. And he said, no, no way, which is kind of amazing when you think about it, because Meet the Press is such an institution among the political establishment. And to me, there's no question that the host of that show is part of the political establishment. He didn't see it that way. And so that failure to recognize who you are and what you're a part of, I think, is also involved in how stunning these events have been for people in the political journalism world.
Stand by, Jay Rosen. We'll just note that Tim Russert would probably not have made that misreading of his own, you know, his own place in the game. Coming up, David Bromwich is an English professor who reads candidates and campaigns and the coverage as if they were books, which is to say, very, very closely. This is Open Source. We're speaking of this 2016 presidential campaign as live history at a jagged turn, what was forecast as a sedate dynastic struggle becoming more like the famous Shays Rebellion of overtaxed farmers in Massachusetts in the pre-constitutional 1780s. I put it to the sterling professor of English at Yale, David Bromwich. Do we yet have a name for the turbulence in this country today, or any idea how it snuck up on our political weathermen?
I think the mainstream media that I've read, stories in the New York Times and watching CNN or reading the other papers that I look at, they don't have a language to describe the strange moment of reaction, resentment, indignation, anger that many currents have fed in this campaign, but to which the mainstream candidates, Hillary Clinton and Kasich, on the face of it, although the media had tried to promote Rubio, of all things, as a good mainstream candidate. That shows just how far out of touch they are and how desperate, I think. But the mainstream candidates don't seem to be any sort of match for the mood. And on the other hand, you have Bernie Sanders with his egalitarian message and frank acknowledgement of crisis about climate disruption and the plutocracy that pretty much has seemed to run this country more than ever before for the last 15 years. And you have Trump, a sort of classic demagogue, but taking the brutality and vulgarity of the pitch to the new level of a sort of ugly, clean sweep and pulling surprising numbers. The media answer for what all this is about is in the single word anger. Anger, they think, is bad, and it should be remedied by comfort, putting people in a comfort zone. And the media have been good at that. On the whole, considering the catastrophe this country has been through in the last decade or so, but it can't meet this crisis. So it's a real inadequate kind of vehicle for understanding what's going on for us.
David, for me, the context is also that the media companies themselves are in a desperate struggle for survival.
Yep.
When they talk about insurgent powers or disruption or a revolution, it's only one step away from themselves.
That's right. And I think they try to scare people with a word like that. One of the earliest articles on Bernie Sanders called him a revolutionist before he started using the word revolution, by which he meant just revolution in control of our own financial instruments. But they called him a revolutionist to scare people. And again, I think caught by surprise, I'm thinking of the New York Times in particular and their reprehensible coverage of Sanders. But people don't scare. Young people don't know what to make of the word socialist, but he explains it to their satisfaction, and they're not scared by that. And if the New York Times says, but revolution, revolution, and this guy brought his child up to call him by his first name, people don't think these touches of nonconformity are as disturbing as the words of comfort that have meant nothing for so long. You know, and of course, they can't resist the in Obama's corner and Hillary Clinton supporting MSNBC can't resist covering Donald Trump because it gets you clicks, it gets you ratings. And Trump figured that out early, and he has found ways of keeping it up. You know, Lenin's line about the last capitalist will hang himself with the last rope.
Yeah. The language in the Times strikes me as bizarre. And I used to write for them, had to get through their editors and stuff. But there was a line in a Straight News report a couple of weeks ago, the end of February, in which two reporters said, now, with Jeb Bush's exit from the campaign, the Republican establishment confronts an urgent decision, either destroy Mr. Trump or embrace him. That sounded like hitman language, almost a call for assault.
It is hitman language, and certainly for a newspaper like the New York Times, which is so cushioned and so accustoming its readers to euphemism, if anything. The word destroyed stands out. I think you're right. Was that in an unsigned editorial?
No, it was a news report by Michael Barbaro and Ashley Parker.
Yeah, and you know, there have been other instances of this. Their in-house conservative columnist, Ross Douthat, if that's the way you pronounce his name, sent a tweet which had a film clip of the scene of killing a politician in David Cronenberg's movie The Dead Zone, extremely affecting and disturbing movie about loss of consciousness, a kind of brainwash condition, and political opportunism and violence, and asked a question something like, what about this for Trump? Something like that. And Ross Douthat really caught it from readers of the Twitter system that this was going too far. But that was a Times columnist and ordinarily a fairly moderate-minded person for an American conservative. But there's great trouble of mind among people who identify with anything that could be called the establishment. And it's curious and very revealing of the moment, I think, that both Trump and Sanders refer to it as the establishment. Trump and Sanders have almost nothing in common except an overlap of a certain kind of voter who votes against and except their shared usage of this term establishment. And I don't recall that that word has been used much in American politics since the early 70s.
It's funny. You and I are old enough to remember Richard Rovere's piece in The New Yorker many years ago about the establishment. And in the end, he said, the establishment is the people who read The New York Times.
Yeah. People who read it and trust it and want to be comforted by it. And the whole mechanism at the Times that contrives to give them the comfort people expect to see delivered. But it has not been possible to do that this year. I think a year ago, everybody was talking about how boring and discouraging it's going to be. We've got two dynasties. Remember that?
Right.
It was going to be Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, and it was a pre-digested understanding. None of it has come true.
It makes you wonder, makes me wonder, David, whether an establishment newspaper in a fading medium can cover establishment politics under assault. Maybe it just can't be done.
Yeah, it can't be done in their style, and it's why there is so much evident shakiness, insecure footing within the style. I mean, at its worst, it is really banal and soporific. I mean, for the Sanders campaign, I think they've been wrong-footed from the start. For one thing, Sanders is a New York type and belong to the, you know, left wing of social democracy. And that's a type, whatever the New York Times has or does not have to do with it, that they should recognize fairly easily. Right. But they treated him as a sort of foreign entity from the start. They first assigned it to a style reporter, Sarah Lyle, who's a pretty capable, smooth journalist, but has nothing to do with politics. She wrote an inappropriate article on Sanders' connection to the 60s that tried to catch him on sexism, used some very unfair tactics to do it, and they quickly retired her from the Sanders beat.
What is the Times up to? What do they think they're doing?
What are any of us up to in our responses to this? It is I think objectively speaking, it's a disturbing moment because you have physical violence, though on a low level compared to what has happened in other countries in Latin America, Europe, etc. But physical violence going on in political demonstrations and an ethic of confrontation, both from some elements on the left with a little overlap with Sanders, Black Lives Matter wanting to confront Sanders' audiences. And then you have members of Trump's audience, the popular audience, singling out anti-Trump protesters and, you know, manhandling them, I think would be the old word. There have been a couple of punches traded in these encounters, but you wanted to stay at that level. But Trump eggs them on and says, I would have liked to punch that guy. And what I thought was the most sadistic and revealing moment of this sort, I think it was in New Hampshire. He said they were dragging a man out into the winter cold. And he said, don't let him have his jacket. Don't let him have his jacket. Let him freeze out there. I think that told us, especially if we were boys on the playground in earlier times, exactly what kind of 9-year-old Donald Trump had been. And he's that same person now as a grown up. And yet it's not being discountenanced. It's not being, rejected by the people who support him. They seem to like him all the more for that. They think it's part of his frankness. I mean, what has to be described is the brutality of this, but it has to be described straight on. And I think the fact that he is a getter of ratings and clicks, along with the usual network and mainstream ethic about fair and balanced coverage, I think it stops them from finding a language for describing Trump accurately. I noticed on CNN the other night, Jake Tapper, you know, he was trying to get Trump to disclaim the violence at his demonstrations. And the strongest language that Tapper could summon was try to dial it back a little, something like that. But he didn't quote the incendiary, the inflammatory statements that Trump has made, like, I'd like to slug him in the face too. Why not quote that to him? And I think the reason wasn't, in this case, cravenness or cowardice, but it's just these media hosts and mainstream reporters have been trained out of the habit of directly confronting extreme things with the language adapted to it. They weren't able to do it about torture, which they called by other names. They weren't able to do it about the straight-on illegality of the Iraq War. And they're pretty resourceless in confronting what Trump may mean and in defining the differences between him and other candidates. I mean, it's a very strange moment.
You mentioned that the Times seemed so uncomfortable talking about Bernie Sanders, who is a very familiar New York, Brooklyn character. You could say the same thing about Donald Trump. I mean, he's been a wide open real estate operator in the heart of Manhattan, which is where the Times lives, and they treat him sort of like a Martian, which he may be, of course. But what do we make of the fact that the newspaper of record, as we used to say, seems so unfamiliar with the territory and the characters?
I think it is something that has been happening to the language of mainstream journalism for a long time. I mean, you have to go to somewhat sharper, with sharp elbows too, sometimes online journalists, people like Matt Taibbi, to find a more appropriate language for what's going on. It has more salt. It has some slang. The Times has given up all that beyond any necessity for doing so. And this has to do with the training that is received by people who go into journalism in their 20s and 30s. It's training they get in what Donald Trump calls political correctness, and unfortunately, I don't have a better word for it. And it is softening down language, which, in my opinion, is no different from dumbing down thinking. It's as if they've never read Mencken, never read even Theodore Roosevelt or say, Russell Baker to come closer to the president. They lack all sharpness and vividness. And I think that's one of their troubles. Sanders is a sharply realized, self-realized, and vivid character. But they can't do anything with their familiar knowledge of him. And they treat his form of Jewishness, which included a moment of left-wing Zionist participation when he worked on a kibbutz in Israel. They treat that as if it's a foreign, a strange phenomenon. And they devoted a whole article to his Jewish identity. Why does he seem less Jewish than Joe Lieberman? Well, he seems less Jewish by the lights of the New York Times because he doesn't talk about Israel all the time. That's what identifies you as somebody like Lieberman. They made a big deal in an article written by somebody else, a man named Joseph Berger, but about the fact that Sanders said that his parents were Polish. And that's supposed to have been some extraordinary defection from identity politics. And the Times endorses identity politics. That's another one of their troubles, because a lot of these protests are reactions in the current of or against the current of identity politics. And yet that's what the Times sort of feeds itself on in its culture, its book review, its style pages. So I think there's a terrible confusion about that. They're afraid to use their own familiar knowledge. And it has converted their coverage of that campaign into almost wholly human interest coverage. And as you say, they do with Donald Trump. I mean, treating Sanders as another Martian.
David, everything you say reminds me of being a young reporter in the New York Times Washington Bureau, struggling against the deadline. And Russell Baker, the great Russell Baker, would wander by my desk and he would say, Chris, just tell him what happened.
That's good.
David Bromwich, part of the media's problem here is they haven't decided what they're describing. Was the Trump entry the mark of a celebrity show?
Right.
Is this an ideological test? Is it the standard run through the primary circuit and see who's ahead? Or was it, you know, hostile takeover? Is it some other model of what we're looking at? More and more, it seems we're looking at a popular revolt against something, a rebellion, a Shays rebellion. I mean, these things happen in history.
Yeah, and populism is not always good, but it's the last resource of a flailing democracy. And the Times and other outlets are not able to describe that either. You know, I listen sometimes to the Fox radio hosts, the call-in shows, the far-right people who really created the Tea Party, Limbaugh and Hannity and others. And Limbaugh, who's got the sharpest political head of all that lot, by quite a margin, was picking up the other day the Wall Street Journal. And he noticed that the Wall Street Journal was denouncing angry white voters as the people who had given Trump his latest victories on Super Tuesday, and then linking them to, quote, angry white voters in Sanders's column. And Limbaugh pointed out that that phrase, angry white people, was invented by the left to describe the mystery of Reagan Democrats, of people going over to Reagan because they felt they were alienated from the culture created by left liberals in politics, but who then ruled the legislative politics anyway of the country. And I think that's right. The Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, CNN, all that lot feel that angry white voters are something quite different from themselves now. Hmm. They don't know how to describe them. But of course, these are people of modest means who are looking at going down economically, at dropping in class. And that's a frightening experience for Americans, because our politicians straight on from Reagan on through Obama have told us that things are getting better, that there's constant progress, and especially economic progress in America. And the disappointment is palpable. The Washington Post runs a story today, it's their lead, I think, about one of these Trump supporters and his family, and how he felt a sudden surge of participation and recognition when he heard Trump say, we haven't had victories in so long. I'm going to give you victories. I'm going to give you so many victories. It's pure demagoguery. Who knows victories of what, about what? But that's what disappointed people, people who feel cheated and swindled in their lives by the way the system is rigged, are reacting to this year's political contest. And the New York Times, which is so closely linked to Goldman Sachs and other such outfits, can't possibly afford to tell the truth about it, but they may not be able to even see the truth that's facing them. I think what scares so many of us now. I would like to count myself as somebody who is rationally fearful about this, is that people aren't able to reason about the troubles they feel. This is something I have noticed in the campus protests too. The campus protests often have a legitimate source in the feelings of alienation of a certain body of students among the undergraduates, but they have become scenes of mass emotion to which heads of universities are capitulating. And to compare the mass emotion on campuses with the mass emotion at Trump rallies is quite scary, because you're talking about totally different groupings within the society. And yet examples of reasoning about an issue that deserves to be argued on, examples of that are in very short supply. So I think what places like CNN, The Times, et cetera, are doing instead is saying, in effect, they're putting exclamation marks and raised eyebrows on it. But that's before thinking begins. You've got to actually make your trek into thinking somewhere.
That was David Bromwich of Yale. His new collection of essays is titled Moral Imagination. His work in progress is a second volume on the mind of the greatest political writer in the language, by his lights, the 18th century English parliamentarian, enemy of the French Revolution, friend of the American version, Edmund Burke. Coming up, the editor-in-chief at Gawker and the reader's advocate inside the New York Times. Also, Jay Rosen of PressThink on who will and who won't get the story straight before it's over. This is Open Source. Are we getting it yet, this disconnect among readings of 2016? A little like the Indian blind man feeling the tail, the trunk, the legs of the elephant and fighting over what it is. Different media send different messages, print, TV, social media, all competing to shape and to name this elephant. Margaret Sullivan is coming to the end of her term as public editor, used to be called ombudsman at the New York Times. She spoke with me pretty candidly this week about the Times' struggle to catch up with events.
I think that everybody's scrambling, and it seems as though traditional news writing hasn't really done the job. And I think only recently have you started to see some stories and some coverage and some opinion pieces about this sort of rising anger in the country. And it's been there for weeks and months, but I don't think that most reporters and editors had really, you know, wrestled it to the ground and really tapped into what people were feeling. And in this case, the people are the heart of the story. And I think, again, I'm starting to see stories that say that, but they are a bit late in coming. And the candidates are sort of a symptom of that rather than the cause of it. You know, so much of this, I think, is about income inequality, and it's about rich versus poor, and it's about the fact that people don't feel like they can get ahead anymore in America. And there's a lot of resentment. And, you know, I think people are grasping for something that will really create change. I mean, I guess in the end, all elections are about hope and change, that hopey, changey thing. And this one is too, but it's in a completely odd way.
It's Margaret Sullivan of the New York Times. Alex Perrine is the college dropout from Minnesota who learned to write his anger into sarcastic online commentary about politics. He's now editor-in-chief of the website Gawker, setting a tone of general disrespect to match the Trump disruption.
We have the luxury here of being able to speak our minds at Gawker. I think we have the luxury of being able to say if someone is a fool or a fraud, whereas if you work for the Associated Press, you sort of have to dance around it, what you actually really think. We are well positioned for this sort of campaign and this sort of election in a way that is sort of distressing for the nation at large, but has made our jobs exceptionally interesting.
Did Gawker language enable Donald Trump? Does Donald Trump extend what you're doing?
You know, there are plenty of things I would blame for the rise of Donald Trump before I blamed Gawker. I think, you know, Gawker could be successful for the same reasons that Trump has succeeded, which is the failure of elite institutions and the erosion of trust in those institutions. So Gawker is an insurgent against the New York Times, as in a similar way that Trump is an insurgency against the Republican establishment. Mm. Obviously, I think our aims and our audiences are different.
Alex, I keep quoting Peggy Noonan's observation that only normal people know what's going on anymore. And maybe there's a liberation in that.
That's remarkably perceptive. I think, I don't know, I think you have to be utterly unfamiliar with the sort of state of America right now if you're shocked that an anti-free trade candidate like Donald Trump would galvanize and energize a lot of people. Being from the middle of the country, I don't claim to have special knowledge about what people in the flyover states think, but I do think I might have some sense. There's not enough class diversity in newsrooms. Mm-hmm. There's so many places that just have this sort of prep school to Ivy League pipeline to a job as a journalist. I think you do have a ton of reporters who sort of look at the working class as the exotic other and cover them as if they're covering another country. But that's a sort of a generational task for the media is to improve that. You have to understand the sources of these resentments, and to do that requires familiarity with these places, and it probably requires some sort of willingness to challenge some of the mainstream beliefs about the American economy and its strength and things like that.
That's Alex Perrine of Gawker. Our guest in the Boston studio is Sarah Sober Eye, professor of sociology at Tufts University, with a particular interest in, should we say, the ragged edge of civility in America, specifically the outrage industry, in the title of a book she co-wrote. Jay Rosen of NYU and PressThink is with us too. Introduce the outrage industry, Sarah. Did it make the outrage, or the outrage make it?
Well, there's always been political outrage, but I would say only in the last 30 or so years has it become so incredibly profitable. And that's happened through a variety of transitions, both in the media landscape and in regulatory structures and also in the cultural environment. But just to take one example, you know, in the 70s, if you have three networks, your primary goal is to attract a wide, broad audience, to offend very few people and to bring in as many people as possible. But in the current landscape, where you've had the advent of cable and Netflix and Hulu, not to mention the internet and all various other spaces where people can communicate, it's very difficult. It's a very competitive media space. And so that encourages people not to sort of draw a broad audience, but to reach out in ways that maybe speak to a segment. And it's okay if some people are offended. So I would say that, of course, there's always been political outrage. I mean, we can go back to Joe Pine or Father Coughlin, but right now, we're in a moment where it's profitable in a way that it hasn't been in the past.
But I'm not clear. Do we give them credit for listening to the people as real Americans and people with a beef, or are we blaming them, as we do blame certainly Father Coughlin, for stirring up a kind of hatred that wasn't there otherwise?
Well, I don't know that we can necessarily conclude that the growth of this outrage industry, the radical expansion of political talk radio, for example, and cable news analysis shows and blogs, I don't know that we can say that's a direct reflection of audience demand. For one thing, there's not a ton of things in the history of commercial media that suggest that the media is that directly responsive to the public. What we can say is that there have been a few early programs that have done well, and then, you know, that prompts the creation of similar programs, and we see things grow and grow and grow. So we know there's an audience for it, but I don't know that the size of the industry is a direct reflection of some latent audience that had always been
there. No, but I'm thinking David Bromwich, also Alex Perrine and others, are talking about legitimate beefs out there, whether it's the war in Iraq, the meltdown, the trade agreements, the loss of jobs in flyover country, you name it, student loans. Is this what feeds the anger out there? Alex was saying, how could you not expect a rabid reaction in the Rust Belt?
Yeah.
About sending jobs abroad.
I mean,
do
absolutely.
We credit them for surfacing something?
I think that, you know, it's not just that there's media industry changes or regulatory changes. There have also been really prominent changes in the cultural environment, like the rise of multiculturalism that came about in the late 80s and 90s where we started to use rhetoric of diversity and tolerance. And even if our social policies have been slower to catch up, we have sort of the general understanding that it's important to showcase those attributes. And so for a segment of the population, particularly conservatives, if they're going to speak about politics publicly, they're taking a social risk that their views on immigration or same-sex marriage or, you know, various other issues are going to have them judged not based on necessarily their opinions, but on who they are as people. The fear of being called racist is something that looms particularly large. So there's a lot of anxiety, I think, and I keep hearing the word anger, and certainly we see anger, but I almost feel as though we lose something deeper than that. And that's part of what you're describing, the sense of insecurity and instability that's making people anxious.
I'm on guard against people who are going to want to blame the anger on the voters, and it's rampant in our media culture, including the right-wing National Review. For example, this is quite striking, but a writer there, Kevin Williamson, roving correspondent, is blaming the Trump voters very, very pointedly. He says the white American underclass is enthralled to a vicious, selfish culture whose main products are misery and used heroin needles. Donald Trump's speeches make them feel good. So does OxyContin. What they need isn't analgesics, liberal or political. They need real opportunity, which means that they need real change, which means that they need U-Haul. If you want to live, get out of Garbutt. There's real contempt there for our citizens, our neighbors.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, one of the undercurrents in this sort of conversation has to do with sort of an anti-intellectualism and an anti-elitism. And I think that it's a segment of the population that feels excluded, that feels judged. And whether the rest of the country likes it or not, this is validating. This feels good. It feels as though their views are being articulated in a way that they haven't felt comfortable articulating themselves in many public spaces. You know, people tend to talk about politics in the United States with only those people who they already know they agree with in the privacy of their own homes. There's a lot of anxiety about social judgment, and not just about, and also we've mentioned economic changes. There's also anxiety around the demographic changes, frankly.
I want to hear Jay Rosen on de-alienating the conversation, reintroducing a kind of, I don't know, initial respect for the complainers. Jay?
Well, I think what you have to remember is that these mainstream news organizations are bureaucracies of fact. They don't exist to make room for individual voices, even though people who work there as journalists imagine themselves as writers and probably went into journalism because they wanted to be writers. They're not allowed to be writers in the sense of an independent voice telling the truth as he or she sees it and trying to wake up his or her fellow citizens. That role isn't allowed them in these bureaucracies because they have to meet commercial purposes. They have to form a consensus product, and they often want to position themselves between extremes or what they imagine to be extremes in order to gain the authority of the middle position, which is basically the entire approach of CNN. And so even if they did have a feel for the life of the country, even if they did have a sense of people's genuine anger, they wouldn't be able to smuggle that understanding through the bureaucracy of fact, because that's not how those institutions work.
Jay, I want to redirect you to, it seems to me, a huge assignment out there to be done, which is to get the measure of this, I'm calling it rebellion, revolt, and judge it in some way. And it's a very, very complicated judgment. But people are talking about, yeah, we're in Weimar America. We're on our way to fascism. Some people want to call it a hostile takeover by the Republican Party, the end of the Republican Party. Some people, as you've heard, want to hear in it Iraq war remorse or resentment about the meltdown. Some response perhaps to this inequality issue that everybody talks about, nobody does anything about. tax reform, et cetera. How do we get a handle? And how many, what kind of a committee of experienced, serious historians, social scientists, reporters, people studying the mood of this country, to get their minds and our attention around it?
Well, is Joan Didion available?
She is.
You know, I
wish Norman Mailer were still among us.
Yeah, I don't know how that is done. It takes a talent that, you know, may be missing on the scene. I haven't seen it.
George yet. Saunders is heading out onto the trail. I mean, we trust his judgment, no?
Well, I don't know. I think it's going to be really hard. I mean, the journalists try to do this in the most superficial way, in that they know the story lies with the voters. They interview voters. They make it their business, especially at campaign events, to talk to the people who are there and try to understand them. And that's good. It's genuine, but it's limited. What this situation takes is somebody who, mindful of the relevant history here, which goes back at least to the administration of George Bush, but really further to where the consensus on trade and the global economy started, somebody aware of that entire context who can read events from the last year into events from the last 40 years. And you're not really allowed to do that in journalism.
Well, I'm talking about very grand journalism, but not beyond the wits of people like Russell Baker, whose name keeps coming up, or Jimmy Breslin, or Murray Kempton, or the great people of the field. I mean, we've got to make a judgment. Is it Weimar America, or is it, you know, student debt and a want of opportunity for young Americans?
You know, one thing I'm thinking is, you know, these are good questions, of course, but that if we focus exclusively on sort of a crisis in traditional journalism, we miss the incredibly vast sea of places that people are getting political information nowadays, whether it's from Rush Limbaugh or from blogs or John Oliver or Samantha Bee or BuzzFeed. You know, there are so many spaces where political information is diffused. And it's diffused often in ways that are outragey. They're snarky. They're funny. They're engaging. And this is a change. So it's not just a change that we're seeing in the way, you know, maybe it's not fair to say politicians in general speak, although I don't think this is limited to Donald Trump, but also a change in the way political information sounds. You know, it was interesting to hear David talk about the language that's used, and I think there's such a variety of ways of speaking across these sort of sources of political information. So it's a pretty broad curriculum.
Incredibly complex cloud out there. Go for it, Jay.
Well, in addition to that, there are so many more sources of information. There's another thing going on, which is in the age of mass media, the audience was not only voiceless, but disconnected from one another. Now, when people think there's something wrong with what they heard on CNN, or when people think there's something crazy about mainstream journalism, they can easily find each other without the journalists being involved at all. So I describe this as audience atomization overcome. Mm-hmm. So it's simple for people to realize that a lot of them are dissatisfied with the portrait they're getting from the media, and for them to find each other and to find voices in blogs and radio shows and podcasts who feel the same way as them. So the elimination of an atomized audience is also involved in the growing mistrust of mainstream media.
Jay, don't we all and Sarah see chickens coming home to roost? I mean, they call us the United States of amnesia for a reason, a sort of perpetual adolescence. We have a dilapidated public conversation, as Tony Judt said in his last breath. We entertain ourselves to death. It's true. I mean, our critical media is enfeebled. I mean, there's a real trouble in the land.
It is sort of remarkable in the sort of moment of the 24/7 news cycle that there can be so much coverage of politics with so little policy information, as came up earlier in the show. And it is enfeebled in that sense that you could spend an entire, you know, hour watching the news without finding out anything except polling information and, you know, who's sweaty and how big their hands are. I mean, this is a concern. And there is a step I think journalists can take in that direction.
But it's hope. We'll stay with it. Thank you, Jay Rosen. Thank you, Sarah Soberai. And to our guests on the phone, David Bromwich of Yale and the London Review of Books, Margaret Sullivan of the New York Times, soon to be transplanted at the Washington Post, and Alex Perrine of Gawker. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Abby Duker. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.